Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful, glorious, and gorgeous Dar Williams singing with Pete Seegrim. David Burns, the Solartopia song, back for another great show, a great hour in Solartopia. I wanted to just tell you that today I put up a piece at Eco Watch, also at PRN, on the Diablo Canyon situation. We had a major decision, court decision. They are going to hear a challenge to the Diablo Canyon nuclear power license. They did some naughty things, let's say, some illegal things at Diablo Canyon. The two reactors at San Luis Obispo between L.A. and San Diego and San Francisco, they discovered that the nuclear plant, the two reactors, could not withstand the kinds of earthquakes that we know can happen there. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission went in and actually lied and changed the license requirements for Diablo Canyon to meet fictional standards that would allegedly account for the earthquake faults that surround Diablo Canyon. And so the federal court, the D.C. Court of Appeals, Federal Court of Appeals, will hear this case. It's very rare that a court gets involved in the internal workings of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but in the case of Diablo Canyon, it looks like they're going to do it. So I have put up a piece at ecowatch.com, also at nukefree.org, also at PRN, which you can take a look at about the situation at Diablo Canyon. We also have breaking news, by the way, and I have David Eisenstein on the phone, do we? Do we have David Eisenstein?
Yes. Hello there, Harvey.
David, I got one more piece of news to break down before I get with you. You're my great guest from Monster Pack, and we're going to talk all about that. But I want to say and congratulate and celebrate the fact that Barack Obama, just within the last few minutes, has vetoed the Keystone Pipeline. That's a big step forward for all of us who are concerned about global warming and saving this planet. It's all over the internet, and now it's all over the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. So thank you, Barack Obama, for vetoing the Keystone Pipeline, and let's hope that we can veto some of the subsidies that you've put forward for nuclear power plants as well, and get ourselves to a green-powered Earth. So, today we have a great show. Our first half hour is going to be with David Eisenstein, the founder of Monster Pack. We're going to find out all about that. He comes to us through the great PR person, Eileen Proctor. And then in the second half hour, we're going to talk to my old buddy, Mark Dowie, who has a new project he's got with Kickstarter. And Mark is one of the great writers of our generation, broke the Pinto story and many others from Mother Jones, and he's going to tell us all about what he's up to now. So, David Eisenstein, we have met. You are a unique and powerful activist. You are working with Eileen Proctor. You have a new thing here called Monster Pack. Spell it for us and tell it what it's all about, if you would.
Will do. Thank you, Harvey. Monster Pack is M-O-N-S-T-A-H Pack, P-A-C. It's a super PAC registered with the Federal Election Commission.
And it's all one word.
It's a progressive super PAC.
What would your website be?
MonsterPack.com, M-O-N-S-T-A-H P-A-C.com.
All right, so let's hear about it. Tell us all about it.
Okay, it's a progressive super PAC. I founded it, and I am the treasurer of it. And we've been operating since the late stages of the 2012 congressional cycle. back in September 2012 as a reaction to Citizens United and as a reaction to the fact I was, my congressman was Daryl Issa at the time, and he still is, unfortunately.
Tell us about Daryl Issa before you go any further. I know it's like being an archaeologist describing a dinosaur, but tell us, please, about Daryl Issa and why he would prompt you to do something like form this PAC.
Well, Daryl Issa is the former chairman of the House Oversight Committee who went on so many wild goose chases that I don't think he would know a real investigation if he tripped over one. Benghazi, we all know the hits. I mean, all these hits just kept coming. And we'd like to take some credit, Harvey, for keeping me away from the role of chairman of the House Oversight Committee, but I don't think we can claim that. We didn't beat him in the elections, but he did lose the chairmanship. They said it was timed out, but I think the real reason it wasn't extended by Speaker Boehner was because his own caucus really has problems with him, can't stand him. He's the wealthiest guy in Congress. He made over $200 million a couple of years ago, doubling his net worth. And how does he do that while he's a member of Congress? Well, he owns 12 different LLCs that own real estate in Southern California, and that's what he's doing in Congress. Really, that's what his real job is. And he liked to showboat. He liked to make it look like he was doing something of substance, and the conservative base really ate it up. But he really wasn't representing District 49, which is really the crux of why I was compelled to do something about it, and many people have been, unfortunately, to no avail so far. But if he runs again in this cycle, 2016, we're going to oppose him again. But let me just explain one quick thing about the biggest reason why we can't afford to have him around as our congressman is that he turned a blind eye to San Onofre's situation. He's totally ignored it. And that's the main reason why we're opposing him.
All right, so very quickly, how did he make his $200 million?
Well, he made his $200 million by, taking the inside information he was getting in Congress by virtue of his powerful seat and his powerful position and turning it into money and a lot of it by getting information first before other people could utilize it, about local developments, hospital construction and office building occupation and, these things have been a real motherlode of wealth for him. He's been, going around buying places up, timely selling them because he knows what's going to happen. He pays attention to those things. He's turned a blind eye to San Onofre, which is the biggest existential problem we have in Southern California, I think, or one of them. I guess it's the biggest. And he pays more attention to, how can he continue to build his own wealth. And
so
that's how he's done it.
Didn't he have some kind of auto security business, or got him wrong with another guy?
No, you got it right. He actually did contribute something with the auto alarm that he developed, and I think his own voice was the guy that says "step away from the car," on one of the alarm devices that's out there. And he made oodles of bucks on that, but he really has become much more wealthy while he's been in Congress, not off of that device, but off of real estate investments, timely real estate investments and other kinds of investments.
All right, so this Daryl Issa is a bad player. He represents your district in Southern California, and he, as you say, has turned a blind eye to San Onofre. Now, San Onofre, we have successfully shut.
Yes.
So tell us what it is that you have an issue with him on and San Onofre and what you want done.
Well, Edison is the entity, it's the publicly traded entity that operates the San Onofre generating station, and it's in a decommissioning status right now. That could take years, many years. And in the meantime, Edison intends to make a lot of profits for its shareholders, and one way of doing that is to shortchange the Southern Californians, 20 million people within a 50-mile radius of San Onofre, which is only 2 miles from San Clemente. is one way of doing that is to go for a plan to store the waste. And by the way, I'm sure you're aware that all the waste that San Onofre has ever created is still there on site. Even though they've shuttered the place, it doesn't operate anymore, at least at this time, and hopefully will never operate again. All the waste is still there, and the way Edison wants to store it, and they've gotten preliminary approvals so far to do so, is to put it into a 5/8-inch thick steel container and bury that in concrete under the sand of the bluffs right overlooking the Pacific Ocean near San Clemente. And that is not safe. That's just not, I mean, patently, you know, that's not very much steel in between 20 million people in this terrible toxic waste. So there's 20-inch thick containers that are being produced in Europe, and Edison has gone with the cheap route and wants to go for the skinniest, thinnest containers that they can. And so far, they have somehow they've gotten the NRC to go along with that and the local regulators here in California. And we're all, you know, the people who care about this issue really are trying to reverse that and get the waste out of Southern California. But of course, there is no safe place to store nuclear waste in this country, and we shouldn't be creating it in the first place. But it is still being created, not at San Onofre anymore, but it's got plenty of waste that needs to be stored in a safe location. But there's nothing that the NRC has been able to develop that is safe. You know, we've got problems with the facility, the storage facility in New Mexico. Yucca Mountain is off the table. So there's really no place to put it, but that's the NRC's job, is to find a place to put it. And in the meantime, they should at least truck this stuff out in safe containers out of the Southern California area and out of the close proximity to so many millions of people.
So what is the purpose of your pass? And tell us about how people can interact with it.
Okay, so the purpose of our PAC is to engage with candidates on public health and public safety issues that affect us all. And you know, we have issues that are in addition to the safe nuclear storage that we are very concerned about. We have climate change on our mind as well. We have, you know, again, Darrell Issa, he won a big award, if you want to call it that, for being the climate change denier of the year from the League of Conservation Voters. So, you know, where he's coming from, and of course, his answer to that is, well, I'm not a scientist. Well, you know, that's just not an answer. It's just not acceptable. It's not representing your district. We all must, you know, face the fact that we have climate change going on, and that we have to take some measures that will allow us to sustain our existence in the midst of climate change, and to try to reduce the effects of climate change and reduce the causes of climate change first and foremost. That's not something that's on Mr. Issa's agenda. It's not on the agenda of many conservative Congress members and the obstructionist majority that now exists there. So we've even got a Senate chairman of the Environmental Committee, Senator Imhoff, that is a climate change denier. You know, great place to put a climate change denier. And unfortunately, I'm being a little bit sarcastic there, but you know, we are opposing candidates that deserve to be opposed on these issues, and we are favoring and we support candidates that for Congress that deserve our support on these issues. And other issues, just a couple other issues, Harvey, to mention that we're involved in and that we are very purposeful about is would include body cameras on all law enforcement personnel for transparency purposes.
Well, tell us about that. Now,
okay.
Tell us about why you would support that.
Well, you know, as a lawyer for 38 years, I've got started in the law. Representing victims of police abuse, and I actually had, you know, quite a few friends in law enforcement too, and I got both sides of the story. But I certainly saw up close and personal deaths created by police abuse of citizens that were unnecessary and not righteous and wrongful. And the usual double speak, the cop speak that comes about after there's been an illegal shooting. Let's just put it that way. A shooting that's deprived the victim of their civil rights by taking their life without due process of law. This kind of a shooting is usually you hear about it from the police department spokesperson after the fact, and somehow somebody pulled a gun and then was shot by a police officer, or pulled something or touched their waistband and the officer thought there was something maybe that could cause harm, bodily harm to him or others, or possibly even his death. And this is just, that's just, if you look at the numbers, it's amazing how little has ever been done to right the wrongs created by police abuse. So, but it's a two-way street. The police have a tough job to do. They need to have the cooperation of the citizens to keep the peace. And so transparency is really important. The police are representatives of our, the taxpayers pay to have police agencies. And so, these government employees can expect to have to obey the constitutional prohibitions against unreasonable searches, unreasonable use of force, and so and deprivation of life, liberty, and property without the due process. So they really have no reason to not have transparency in the work that they do. It actually is for their own protection as well, because the studies have shown, there's a study that was done in Rialto, Arizona, that this actually reduces problems of complaints against police and also reduces actual incidents of assaults, either by civilians on police or by police on civilians, and reduces them substantially because of the fact that there's a camera. And,
right.
Yeah, there are some, some possible privacy concerns that have to be worked on and worked out, but the police don't have, it's not a matter of their privacy, they're government employees, but it's the citizens that would have a privacy concern.
I've just recently read an article, a pretty in-depth article about whether or not police have the right to stop you from videographing or shooting film or taping their police work, making arrests or doing other things. And the article indicated pretty definitively that the police do not have the right to take a camera away from you when you are filming them in the line of duty, because we have plenty of instances, and of course some of them are on film, of cops walking up to people and forcibly taking their cameras away or their cell phones away to prevent them from being videographed or filmed in the process of arresting someone or doing whatever they do. Do you agree with that? Is it a basic First Amendment right or an other amendment right for a private citizen in the United States to video a police person doing their work if the police person doesn't want to be videoed?
Yeah, I agree with that totally. I think that there may be an exception where, and I can't even imagine the circumstances where this would be present or possible, but I suppose some court might come up with an exception for it. If you're creating a breach of the peace by doing this, and it's unreasonable to do so. In other words, a breach of the peace that wasn't going to happen without your getting involved in an obtrusive and aggressive way. I suppose there may be some room for a little exception there, but no. I mean, this is, like I said, this is part of the police, what their expectations should include as government employees. They're public servants, and I don't mean that to be gloating or anything about their role vis-a-vis dangerous criminals, and being a public servant and serving and protecting doesn't mean that you have to be unsafe when you confront dangerous individuals that are trying to kill you or cause you bodily harm. It doesn't mean you can't have defense of your life or the life of others, but you better expect that the public is going to be very interested in how you're doing your job, because life and death is at stake.
So you are an attorney, and you are confirming, and all you Silvertopians out there listening to this show, you have the right to video an officer, a police officer in uniform, doing his or her job. And you know, police will have repeatedly come up to American citizens and said, no, you can't videotape my work, and I'm taking your video camera, and or your cell phone. And that is illegal. And it's actually destruction of evidence, as far as I could read that article. So from now on, all Solartopians should understand that when the cop tells you to stop filming, you say no. You have the right to film, and the cop does not have the right to take your cell phone. Am I correct with that, attorney?
I agree with that.
Right, well,
this is one attorney's opinion, and I don't know at all, obviously, but I do believe that. And I do have one other item of breaking news. Your breaking news has been really great today and important. Can I add something else?
Please.
It's along the lines of what Monsterpack is doing. Monsterpack supports the proliferation of automated external defibrillators. And these devices are also known as AEDs for short. And they save lives. There's 360,000 people a year who are in a non-hospital situation. Not in other words, not in the hospital when they have a sudden cardiac arrest, and they're dead within 4 or 5 minutes if an AED is not applied to them. And with CPR and an AED applied to people, 60-70% will survive, even if they're not in a hospital situation. And the EMTs, that's not enough time for EMTs to arrive to give, in almost all cases, they can't get there fast enough within 4 or 5 minutes, and that's all people have once they have a sudden cardiac arrest. So today, I'm announcing on your show, Harvey, and I think it's a perfect show for this announcement, that I have a client whose daughter fell over backwards, suffering from a sudden cardiac arrest, 49-year-old, developmentally disabled, Mary Ann Verdugo from Maywood, California, which is a neighborhood of Los Angeles, and they were shopping at the Pio Pico Target Superstore. Fell over backward, had a sudden cardiac arrest. Target had a policy of not having AEDs, didn't have an AED. The EMT people didn't get there to apply one to Marianne for 16 minutes, and she could not be revived because Target had chosen not to have AEDs in their big superstore that, you know how huge these big box stores are. So we've been going through the courts on that case, and I'm this week, by Friday, I expect to file in the United States Supreme Court a petition for a writ of certiorari for the court to hear this case and resolve the issues of allowing us to do discovery and go to trial on a theory of negligence and get a fair trial, which is guaranteed to people even in civil cases under the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution. Monsterpack supports the proliferation of AEDs. And with the proliferation of AEDs, a large portion of the 360,000 people per year that suffer from the sudden cardiac arrest will be saved.
That's amazing. Now, I remember a case that took place on an airplane. Mm-hmm. United Airlines was sued because they did not have a defibrillator on the airline. Someone died, and I think they lost.
Yeah, they all have to have them now. And, there's been a lot, several aeronautical cases, and it's understood that they must have one now. That's part of the federal regulations. All federal buildings, including all the courthouses, all the judges are protected by AEDs. All the state court buildings in California are protected, and the people that come in them are protected by AEDs. The judges and everybody else that's an employee of the state should have an AED in their building, and the schools have to have them, and the fitness studios. And why don't the big box stores like Walmart and Target have these things? Another sudden cardiac arrest resulted in someone's death without an AED being present at Walmart's store in Pittsburgh late last year. So this is real. It's also existential for these people that don't get any help from these big box stores that they're the customers of. and we want to change that. So, I
okay. So
you know, one thing. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to. I'm sorry.
No, go please.
I just wanted to mention that we're going to have our launch celebration for Monster Pack in Santa Monica on February 28th, which is this coming Saturday from 5:30 to 10 p.m. We're going to have political speeches. We're going to have food and drinks, dinner and drinks, and we're going to have wonderful fun at the end to lighten the mood a little bit after the political speeches. So we're going to have a great magic show at Magicopolis is the venue, and it has a wonderful theater and stage and a wonderful team of magicians that are going to entertain us at the end of the event. We would love for you, Harvey, and your listeners to all come and be with us on that occasion, February 28th in Santa Monica on 4th Street.
That sounds terrific. So I will definitely put this out on the web. You'll be able to broadcast this podcast to your nets. And tell us again now, we just have a couple minutes left. What is Monster Pack, and how can people, what is its primary purpose, and how can people plug into you?
Well, Monster Pack is to support good candidates and oppose candidates that deserve to be opposed on the issue of public health and safety, including the likes of Senator Frey. And we have a much more progressive and democratic way of raising funds. Rather than have the billionaire class fund our deal and tell us what to do with the money, we have people contributing $500 to become a member of our network, 2016, Monster Pack Network 2016. We ask them to contribute $500, to find two more people who will do the same thing, and to help those two people do the same thing, and so on and so forth until you get 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. The concept, the principle of doubling takes hold, and that's how we'll raise our money in a more progressive and democratic manner.
And you are supporting candidates against incumbents like Daryl Issa. Do you have someone who's running against him that you're going to support?
We don't at this time in the 2016 cycle, but there are a lot of good people in this district, you know, the District 49 in which Issa has prevailed several times to become congressman. So we know we can find a really good candidate. And, you know, of course, I say it goes without saying the wealthiest man in Congress is going to have the funds to, you know, do what he thinks needs to be done to preserve his seat. But we have a strategy that we've devised to work on a lower budget. We're never going to be able to level the playing field with the billionaire class-supported super PACs where the 501c4s buy Rove and his ilk for dark money. People that didn't want to be disclosed. That's not our strategy. Our strategy is to go with other alternative means of communications, social media and billboards and the like, TVs, the ads, yes, they may be utilized as well, but they're not necessarily to get a place on the playing field. And everybody listening needs to get off of the sidelines and onto the playing field with us and, of course, with Harvey.
Okay, so tell us again, David Eisenstein, how to get in touch with you and where your Monster Pack website is, and you can repeat where your event's going to be. It's been a great having you on here.
Thank you so much, Harvey.
Give us basically the basic information. And one more time.
We're going to have our launch celebration, Monster Pack Network 2016. It's kicking off its launch at Magicopolis in San Diego. That's Magicopolis, something like that. Magicopolis is how it's pronounced, in Santa Monica. It's a wonderful, fun place, and it's on 4th Street in Santa Monica, right in the middle of the downtown area, right next to the beach. Love to have everybody come and support that launch and have a great time with food, drink, and political speeches, as well as the fun two-hour magic show at the end of the night. It'll be awesome. And you can contact us on our website at MonsterPack, MonsterPack.com. See us on Facebook. We have a very dynamic page, we think, on Facebook, which is Facebook.com/MonsterPack, MonsterPack. And you can email me at dge@MonsterPack.com. And be happy to respond to anybody that wants information about Monster Pack.
Well, let me see now. Can I introduce you to Mark Dowery? Is Mark Dowery with us on the phone? Resounding silence. I think Mark's not yet with us. He's someone you should know, actually. Mark is a journalist in Northern California and has broken some of the great stories of our time, including the story on the Pinto way back when with Mother Jones. But David, we'll play a little bit of the Soarotopia song, and we won't break. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us?
Just one last thing. If you really want to be entertained in light of what I've said about Mr. Issa and our campaigns against him and our continuing campaign against him being congressman of our district, go on to our YouTube channel, Monsta Pax channel, M-O-N-S-T-A-H, Pax channel of YouTube, and check out our 6 videos that we produced in the last election cycle that we're very, very, very proud of, and think that they are very easy to watch. They're very short, but they're very to the point. So I'm going to commend those to you.
All right, very good. We'll listen a little bit to the Dana Lyons song, and we're not really going to break. We'll go straight into Mark Dowdy. Thank you so much.
Harvey, thank you.
And I look forward to seeing you out there in Southern California.
All right, sir. Nice to talk to you again. Take care.
Okay, take care.
Bye, Harvey.
New plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Home sweet home to me, Soarotopia, that's the future for me, green powered energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere, solar cars, fast trains, bicycles, hydroplanes, get you home in under an hour.
Thank you, Dana Lyons, and thank you guys in New York for pulling that off. I hope we have Mark Dowdy with us. Mark, are you there?
Yep.
All right, Mark. Mark Dowdy, my good old buddy. I'm looking at a picture of you with a hat and a beard standing out at the Point Reyes Sanctuary with the ocean in the back. You look terrific. How you been?
Been fine. How you been, Harv?
Oh, I've been good. I'm good, actually. I'm in Central Ohio. Talk to you now. On what is the coldest day in recorded history in Central Ohio. It is like about 8 degrees below zero. People are just freaking out. And of course, everybody's running and saying, well, no more global warming. But of course, we know it's all about global weirding. And when you screw up the environment, Mark, you get ultra extremes. So you are still in that gorgeous place in Point Reyes National Seashore. Is that right?
Yeah, and I went to college 23 miles from where you are right now, and I remember some cold days there, but not that cold.
No, and you had the good sense to get the hell out of here, so hopefully I'll be out in a while, too. So you and I have taken some fabulous walks on the Point Reyes Beach. You still have that beautiful golden dog?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, good for you. And, Mark, I got to tell my listeners, you exercise every morning by getting in a kayak and going on the
it's a rowing shell.
Oh, it's a rowing show. Okay.
Yeah.
Pardon me. Are you still doing it every morning?
every morning I can, yeah. You know, bad weather, I don't go out in bad weather, but, you know, when the weather's good, I do, yeah.
I can't even begin to, I'd love to be able to describe to my listeners how beautiful it is. You have a dock behind your place, you go out on Tomales Bay, which is undeveloped. I mean, you know, I saw a wonderful documentary film called Rebels with a Cause about how Northern California was preserved. And you live in one of the most beautiful places on earth, and I'm just trying to soak in talking to you from that area. Now, you are one of the great journalists of our generation, Mark Dowie, D-O-W-I-E. You broke the story about the Pinto for Mother Jones magazine in God knows what year. What was it, 1843, something like that?
It was 1977, and you know something, Harv? I've written 200 investigative reports since then, and that's the one that keeps haunting me for some reason. It's not even my best work by far.
Well, tell us what is. What's your best work?
Oh, it's still to come.
Oh, all right, we like that. Absolutely. Well, you being a spring chicken, a young guy still with your knees and all that stuff, you are working on a very interesting project now. You have it on Inkshares, which I really don't know much about. So tell us first, Mark Dowie, about your project, and then about Inkshares and how people can support it.
Yeah, my project is, I describe it as a strategic playbook for indigenous sovereignty. I've been spending a lot of time researching the history of an archipelago of islands south of Alaska called Haida Gwaii, which is the homeland of the Haida people. They've lived there for about somewhere between 10 and 13,000 years.
Can you spell that, Mark, before you jump ahead? Spell that, if you would.
Haida is spelled H-A-I-D-A. Gwaii is spelled G-W-A-I-I.
All right.
And it's a cluster. It's 130 islands, they've been inhabiting, they've been thriving on these islands for 10,000 years. They're really a remarkable nation of people. Their art is in every museum in the world. They have a written language, and they have a body of literature, a lot of things that are unusual for native people around the world. They're really extraordinary. Well, for the last 50
how many years, are there? How many people are there on this 130 islands?
Less than 3,000.
And it's all one tribe.
Yeah, it's the Haida. Yeah,
amazing. Mm-hmm. All right, let's hear it.
For the last 50 years, they've been fighting against colonialism, imperialism, and the extractive industries of the world. It's a very, very lush cluster of islands. It's known as the Galapagos of the North because there's so many, such a variety of species. There are more species in Haida Gwaii than there are on the Galapagos. So it's really, really rich in fish and fur and timber and everything that the extractive industries want. So they've been plagued for years. For 150 years, they were just plagued with extractions of one sort or another. And they decided to fight against it, and starting about 40 years ago, really. They won in 2009. What were known as the Queen Charlotte Islands now became known as Haida Gwaii, which is what they'd always been to the Haida. And they were given by the Canadian Supreme Court, were granted land tenure, autonomy, and sovereignty. So it's a major, major victory for a small First Nation. And I believe that the way they did it could be used by any one of the 3,000 or 4,000 other native communities around the world that are struggling for sovereignty inside the nations that enveloped them 100 or 200 or 300 years ago.
So these islands are in Canada.
Yeah, Canada. Yes, right. Yeah.
Okay, and you're Canadian too, by the way, right?
I was born in Canada. Yeah, I live in Canada. I've lived in the U.S. most of my life, but I was born in Canada. Yeah.
But I know you well, and you don't say a boot.
My children teased me out of that.
Okay. All right. So, tell us, how did they win? Tell us real quickly, because we're going to get. I don't want you to lose track.
Because I'm writing. It's a very long lecture, which I won't give you. Basically, but I'll tell you generically what they did. They used the right tactics in the right order. Most people who are protesting against larger powers and extractive industries and everything, they do it all wrong. They just go out and demonstrate, and they get a bunch of hippies to go and hold up signs for them, and they think, you know, that the public and the media and the courts and the government are going to come their way. It's not that simple. It took these people 40 years to do this, and they did it step by step by step. They used the courts at the right time. They used direct action at the right time. They exploited the media at the right time. They got the public involved, the environmental movement, but all their timing was perfect. And I now believe, by studying carefully what they did, that their model of winning sovereignty is transportable anywhere in the world. An indigenous tribe in Indonesia, in Kenya, Uganda, and Thailand, anywhere in the world can use these same tactics and win sovereignty. So I want to document what they did.
All right, well, tell us about your project and what you're going to do, and then we'll go back to the content here. So you are with a thing called Inkshare. What is that?
Inkshares is a publishing company, but it's crowdfunded, so it's like Kickstarter meets Random House. So you take a book idea to Inkshares. They like it. They'll say, okay, how much do you need, and what kind of a book do you envision, and what kind of a press run. So you work with them, and then you come up with a dollar amount, which includes what I need to go up to Haida Gwaii, and what the cost of editing, the cost of designing, printing, and distributing the book, and they come up with a big number, right? In my case, it's $28,000. And they that includes everything. That includes everything, printing, everything. So they come up with that number, and I have to raise that amount through crowdfunding. And the advantage to doing it that way is that if I do raise the amount, the book gets printed, gets distributed by Ingram, the largest distributor in the world, and I get 50% royalties. So it's a new model of publishing that's very appealing to writers who have, as I do, a large enough following that they'll support a project like this.
What do Inkshares do for you?
They publish the book, and they distribute the book. They edit the book. They design the book. They print the book.
And do they let you have a say in the basic formatting and
absolutely. This book, okay. This is my book, not their book. All they do is, I design the book. I say what art is in the book. I work with an editor, but the editor is not a commander, though, like most book editors are. That are, you know, the relationship of most book editors to the writer is the relationship of the knife to the throat. And I'm done with that. I don't need to do that anymore. I've done seven books.
You're not done, have we?
I've done seven books that way, Harv. That's enough. Okay. So I like this model because the writer is in control of the book.
And so, your editor is going to review what you write?
Well, my editor is an old friend of mine. She drew me into this. She will do the line editing and the copy editing and work with me on structuring the story and everything. But she's not the knife to my throat the way every other editor I've ever worked with is, right? She's a friend who loves the project, brought me in to do it. So I'm looking forward to it. I've worked with her many times over the years. She's an editor at Orion magazine, and I love her. She's great. We were good friends. We've worked together many, many times. And so it's going to be a good relationship this time.
All right. So then what do you need from the public? What would you like to tell all the Solartopians listening to this show about how they can get your book published?
Well, if they go on to the Inkshares website, and all you need to do is Google the word Inkshares, right, plural, Inkshares, you'll find the website. You'll find my project there. It's called The Haida Gwaii Lesson, or just look for my name, and everything you need to know will come up. So I don't want to give you a big long string of internet letters. Just do that. If you're really interested, go to the Inkshare. You should go to the Inkshare site anyway, because it's a fascinating book publishing thing, and you can see it all working on the site. It's very exciting, and there's some really interesting books being done there.
Like what, for example?
Well, they're just novels, good novels. So there's a new history of Winston Churchill that's on there that's really good. There is there's some, you know, it's whatever you like. It's a big publishing company. There's science fiction, politics, environment, everything that you're looking for is there in their growing catalog. And of course, most of the catalog that you see now are books that are being funded and books that are in progress. They've only got about 20, 25 books actually in print now because they've only been in existence for a year.
Uh-huh.
So, in
order to get this book published, you will raise funds on this crowd share.
Yeah.
And then that money will be used to print the book, and then they will handle the distribution and the production of the book. Is that it?
Yeah, the major shareholder in Inkshares is Ingram. That's good news. Because Ingram is the biggest and most aggressive book marketer in the world. And so so your book will be distributed and marketed by Ingram.
Cool. Good.
Yeah, great.
Well, I have my books published at Lightning Source, but I designed them myself, and I, you know, like you, I had enough of editors. Although I had a couple of good editors.
I did too. And Jennifer Son, who's my editor at Inkshares, is one of the good ones.
Uh huh.
But I can count on one hand the editors I ever want to work with again.
Yeah. Well, I had one at Harper & Row, Hugh Van Dusen. He was terrific. And then I had one at Dell named Gary Luck, and he was terrific. Beyond that, I had Jeff, somebody at Macmillan, but they're gone. So I haven't done that for many, many years. Been printing my books myself. Distribution's a problem, though. So how are they going to distribute your book? Are they going to advertise it and push it, or is that up to you?
How did Ingram become the largest book distributor in the world? How do you think they did it? They know what they're doing. I don't know what they're doing, but they know what they're doing because they became the largest book distributor in the world. So I just rely on their track record. I don't care how they do it.
Okay. All right, so Inkshares, we've done that. Now, let's go back to the Haida Gwaii. Tell us as much as you can, or you're willing to, in the last 10 minutes that we have about what their relationship to the land is like, and how they've protected themselves.
Well, you know, like so many surviving indigenous tribes and communities in the world, these people are very, very close to the land. I mean, they consider themselves relatives of the wildlife on the island. And the wildlife is amazing. I mean, there's endemic species there. The largest black bear, subspecies of black bear in the world is on Haida Gwaii. Now, ask yourself how the hell that happened. How did the most animals that end up on islands get smaller, right? But here's this black bear that somehow got onto an island 50 miles off the coast of British Columbia and bred itself up to be the largest black bear on the planet. So go figure that one out. That's one of the big mysteries of Haida Gwaii. There are many mysteries.
Well, they were protected. No,
Harvey. No. That's not how it works. You know,
okay.
If you shrink an ecosystem, generally most of the species in that ecosystem will diminish in size. It defies that rule of nature. So nobody understands why this happened. Nobody does.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff in the Galapagos, too. And in any island ecology has a lot of really unusual stuff going on. I mean, like Madagascar has all these lemurs that don't exist anywhere else on the planet. Amazing creatures, right? Amazing, beautiful creatures. And there's some like that in Haida Gwaii. There's a lot of, the, of course, in the Galapagos. So it's an interesting ecosystem, and it's studied by wildlife biologists from all over the world. Spent a lot of time in Haida Gwaii studying the wildlife there. It's amazing.
So well, you said it's 100 and some islands, 150 islands?
Yeah, it's 150. About 130 of them are habitable. The rest of them are just rocks in the middle of the Pacific, right?
But how wide and deep is the geographical area that these islands are spread over?
Well, on the coastal side, the water is just at normal depth. It's actually a little bit shallower than most coastal water, and it's actually very treacherous water because of the combination between the weather, the currents, and everything. It's very treacherous to get over there from the mainland. On the other side of the island, it drops off to 3,000 feet almost immediately, and it's one of the best fisheries in the world, and which has made it attractive to big fishing, right? So big fishing is there, big fur is there, big timber is there, big tourism is everybody big that wants a piece of this incredibly beautiful and fecund and productive place is there. And they've had to fight them back, you know, for years. And without the help of the Dominion of Canada, without the help of the province of British Columbia, they've just had to fight them back, and they have. They're a very, very ferocious and militant people, but militant like Martin Luther King was militant. He was nonviolent militant, but they've stood their ground.
How are they educated?
Self-educated. I mean, they pass their tradition, like all indigenous people, they pass their traditions on through oral stories, which they do not like anthropologists and people like me to come in and steal, which I don't and I won't. But again, as I said earlier, they're one of the few indigenous tribes in the world that have a written language, very sophisticated written language, and a body of literature in that written language. So they've educated themselves over 10,000 years, and they're remarkably well educated. I've got pictures of them at the turn of the 18th and 19th century sitting around with books in their hands, right? How often did you see that in the world in the 18th and 19th century? Not very often. So they're educated in the canon. I mean, there are a lot of people up there who've read Aristotle and Plato and can cite them. So they're amazing people, amazing people.
When did they develop their own written language? Do you know the history of it?
Yeah, gradually over the years. If you look at it, it's kind of it looks like a Cyrillic language. And, you know, that was all part of Russia at one point. And you know, Russian, they may have originated, or Russians came and taught them. Nobody really understands it. It's a Cyrillic looking language. It's not like the Anglo alphabet at all.
Because the Cherokee are famous for having they actually commissioned a member of their tribe whose name was Sequoia in the middle 1810s to devise a written language for them.
Yeah,
because they were confronting the whites and they needed a constitution and a newspaper, and so this guy in 2 years, Sequoia, was paid by the tribe, and he invented a 28-character written language. To my knowledge, the first in North America. But you're saying that this evolved over a longer period of time among the Haida Gwaii.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, Harv, I don't know exactly how it originated and how it did, but you've raised a question which I will know the answer of the next time we talk. And that is, you know, the historical origin of the Haida language. But I do know it's their own. They developed it themselves. It's very complex. There is a dictionary of Haida, that Haida to English dictionary, which I do have. But the origins of the language and the evolution of the language itself is a good question. I'll have to ask Noam Chomsky or some.
Well, now, do they have an elected government?
Yes. Very, very democratic. Like the Iroquois, they've always been very democratic. And, you know, and like most cultures in the world, it was more patriarchal than we would have liked. Although it's matrilineal, like a lot of native cultures, it's patriarchal, but less so now than ever. I mean, women have a lot of power in that society, and that's been evolving over the last 100 years or more.
Well, yeah, you know, you mentioned the Iroquois. They were... they were matriarchal as well. In fact, they had a tribal council, as you know, which was democratic, and it was all men who were the chiefs, but they were all chosen and could be removed by the women. And I saw a wonderful interview. This may be relevant to the Haida Gwaii. It's an interview with a woman, an Iroquois woman. They asked her why, if the women ran the tribes, were the men the chiefs? And she said, well, it gives them something to do, and it makes them feel important.
I think that's true in a lot of native tribes around the world, actually. I mean,
yeah.
You go visit you know, a lot of tribal communities around the world, and you see the men sitting around smoking ganja and stuff like that, while the women are doing all the work. They're gathering the water, they're cooking, they're doing everything, and the men are sitting around deciding, the future of the world, or some big power question that's irrelevant to them. And that is what the women will say. We got to keep them busy, so we give them big hats to wear and feathers and.
Yeah, well, you and I, being veterans of the marriage institution, understand that very well.
Yes, we
do. Now, do you have a photographer that's going up there with you to take pictures?
There is. I don't need one because there is tons and tons of photography. But I don't think that's where I'm going to illustrate the book. There's a brilliant Haida comic book artist named Michael Yongelatis. And I'm hoping I can persuade him to illustrate this book as a running strip, running comic strip, which he's really brilliant at, as a way to illustrate the book. Haida art is wonderful, and he does these comic strips in a Haida art form. So that's why I'm sort of hoping to illustrate the book. There's tons of photography. There doesn't need to be any more. And besides, this isn't a photo book. It's a strategic playbook for Native people.
Now, is there any evidence, and this is a question I hate to ask, but I'm sure it's on the minds of some of my listeners, is there any evidence of contamination from Fukushima in these islands? Got this quick. We're about to leave.
No, I don't think so.
All right, good. Mark Dowry, thank you so much for being with us. I'm going to have you back to talk about your fantastic career. Give us the website real quick for your project.
No, just go to Inkshares.
All right, Mark Dowry, thank you so much. Enjoy Point Reyes. We'll be back next week.